Good day, everyone. I hope you all had a great summer and found some time to spend with family and friends. Thank you to our clients and our colleagues for tuning in for our call today. Now, before we jump into the call, I'd like to take a moment to recognize today, September 11th, 2001, was one of the worst days in America's history. It was also a day where we saw some of the bravest acts in our country's history as well. We will always honor the heroes of 9/11. Now, as we all know, the U.S. presidential election is coming in November of this year, and that is on top of mind for many of us when considering the impact it will have on the markets and on our investments. Last night, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump held their first presidential debate. Today, we will discuss takeaways from the debate, our latest views on the state of the race, and investment implications. I'm joined virtually out of Washington, D.C. by John Savercool, head of the UBS U.S. Office of Public Policy. And here in the studio in New York, I'm joined by Salita Marcelli, our Chief Investment Officer in the Americas. Thank you both again for joining us today. Now, as a reminder for all those watching and tuning in, you can submit any questions on your screen, and we'll be able to address them at the end of our program. So, John, let me start with you. Thank you for joining us today. Let's start with your reaction to the debate. What were your takeaways, and did anything surprise you?
Well, thank you, Jason, and nice to be with everyone today. If you look at last night, the target audience for both campaigns, for both the Trump and Harris campaigns, were really the small number of voters who are still undecided. It's really about 6 to 8% of the population doesn't know how they will vote. They are really the independent voters, those coveted independent voters that we often hear about. Those are the voters who were really targeted for last night's speech. Most people who watch the debate already know who they're going to vote for. They're committed to either Trump or to Harris. They watch the debate for entertainment value. But the 6 to 8% of people who tuned in not knowing how they're going to vote, they were the key vote. And I think Kamala Harris won over most of those voters, or at least created a better impression in their mind. So I think she has to be judged as the winner of last night's debate for that purpose. I thought that she was cool and composed. She met a threshold of being perceived as someone who kind of had her act together. I think she put Trump on the defensive a lot in last night's debate and was able to get him to talk about things that voters cared less about. And in the process, he did not attack her or score any points on her on areas where she was more vulnerable, such as inflation and immigration. So I think overall, a good night for Kamala Harris. I would give her the win last night, and she moves on.
So, John, staying with VP Harris, she had made up a lot of ground in the immediate weeks after replacing President Joe Biden on the ticket. Where do we stand now with their first debate in the books? Does either candidate have a notable edge, especially in the key battleground states?
Yeah, so prior to the debate, the race was basically even. Harris had a slight lead in the national polling, but that is to be expected. It is very likely that even if Trump wins the Electoral College, Harris is likely to win the popular vote. So we should expect to see her in the lead in the national polling. In the crucial swing states, the races were virtually tied. In the more southern swing states of Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina, Trump was a little ahead. In the Midwestern swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Harris is slightly ahead. So I think that what we'll see as a result of last night's debate is Harris opening up her lead very slightly in the three Midwestern swing states, being a little more competitive in the southern swing states. And I think she has a slight advantage in this race as of today. Polling will come out in the next few days, maybe as we approach this weekend. about voters' new thinking as a follow-up to the debate. We should have a better sense then, but my sense is that Harris gained a couple points last night. It's not enough to assure that she'll win the presidency. There's still a lot of time between now and when people vote. But I think last night and over the next week or so, we will see a small lead for her grow to be slightly larger, maybe a 5-6 point national lead. And in the swing states by a couple of points in virtually all of them, with the exception of maybe Arizona. So I think she's in a little better position, not a commanding position, but in a better position than she was as of last week.
Very helpful. Thank you, John. Salita, let's turn it to you here in the studio. Now, is the election driving the market yet, or is it still too early?
Thanks, Jason. Great to be with you and John here on the election. So I would say overall, it's still not the main factor impacting the markets right now. And that's because, first of all, there are more pressing drivers in the market, most notably the economic data. Specifically, I would say labor market data, especially after a string of weaker reports. And even today, it's really the CPI data that is driving the volatility, not necessarily the debate from last night. So I would say the focus, Jason, is still in the here and now. The election is still 2 months away, which sounds close, but as you know, in politics, that's like decades. So I still think for the markets, it's not a priority yet. And then I would say secondly, right, because this race has ended up becoming so close, it makes it difficult for the market to price a specific outcome, right? That doesn't mean we're not going to see knee-jerk reaction along the way, right? Earlier in the year, we have seen an obvious Trump trade after his debate with President Biden. Rates spike, banks rallied, green investments were volatile. And today, we see some signs of a Harris trade with the solar stocks outperforming. But I would say in the absence of a clear outcome, some of these election-related moves are not going to be sustainable. And we have seen already like how quickly the momentum shifts. Now, all of that said, there is one politics-related development that is actually impacting the markets, and that is the rhetoric around the semiconductor export restrictions, right? This is one area that has bipartisan support, and I think it will get caught up in the crosshairs from both sides. From our perspective, regardless of the election outcome, we expect to see more restrictions continue to emerge on this industry, ranging from all the way from manufacturing to finished chips. Now, I would say for now, we believe the financial impact from these restrictions are manageable. And because of that reason, we still have a most preferred rating, most preferred preference on the technology sector. And also, I think some of the impact would be partially offset by production shifts. We are already seeing an increase in plant construction for semiconductor technology outside of Southeast Asia, and that could accelerate. But nonetheless, I think over the next couple of months, it's going to be volatile. It's going to be a risk for us to monitor, especially because the semiconductor supply chain is so concentrated that any disruption would bring more uncertainty.
Very helpful. You mentioned the semiconductors, the tech sector in general. You could see some election volatility regardless of candidate. Any other sectors you are watching right now as it relates specifically to the campaign?
Yeah. So, overall, elections are not the major factor that is driving or the main factor that is driving our views on any sector. Typically, there are other macro and micro factors that are playing bigger role in our views. But that being said, maybe I'll just go through a few sectors that are more sensitive to elections. And I'll start with financials, because that's front and center. And there, personnel is policy, right? A Trump administration will likely nominate new heads for agencies like the Fed, OCC, FDIC, and other agencies who would interpret the current regulations more leniently. That means potentially a lower compliance cost and easier liquidity and capital requirements. So I would say, you know, we probably would see less anti-consolidation pressure there as well. And it's really important to note, because in the United States, where we have about 4,300 or so banks, so it's a sector that is much more prone to mergers and acquisition. So I would say this is what we think, have to think about with a Trump presidency. On the other hand, a Harris win, I don't think will make much of a difference. I think it will be more of the same. So we're not seeing necessarily a major increase in the headwinds for the financial sector there, or in addition to what we already have, I guess. Another election-sensitive sector is obviously energy, right? But even there, maybe the impact would not be as much as one would expect, right? Because since 2018, the U.S. energy industry has become highly focused on capital discipline. That means maximizing return on investments and taking a longer-term perspective on commodity prices and on capital spending. So all of this has tempered companies' reaction to changing commodity prices, changing administrations and regulations. Now, all of that said, still, we believe a red sweep would result in slightly lower legislative and regulatory risk for the fossil fuel industry, and it would probably lead to more consolidation, more exports of natural gas. On the other hand, a Harris win would provide some relief for the renewable energy investments, especially because of fears around the repeal of at least parts of the Inflation Reduction Act would be lifted. And even there, though, I don't think the impact would be so drastic. I don't think it's likely that Inflation Reduction Act would be repealed, especially because there's so much committed funding in place, and there is significant solar and wind capacity in the Republican districts.
Very helpful. John, let's go back to you in D.C., and we talked about the top of the ticket. Let's go to the congressional races. What are you seeing right now? Are there any particular key races that you're watching?
Well, there are a lot of competitive races this year, and with the razor-thin majorities that the parties have in both the House and the Senate, each race is crucial. In the House, Republicans have an advantage of four seats and therefore have the majority. There are a number of close races in the states of New York and California. They will determine whether Democrats or Republicans will have the majority after this election. My sense is that whichever party wins the White House will likely win control of the House of Representatives as well. And it will come down to a handful of seats in California and to a lesser extent, New York. So if things look better for Kamala Harris at the national level with the Electoral College, then I would further elaborate on that and say that Democrats will likely have control of the House of Representatives under a Harris win. The Senate is different. The Senate has a Democratic majority of one, and one of those, and the majority has really been due to Democrats holding the seat in West Virginia held by Joe Manchin. Manchin is retiring. That seat will certainly be filled by Republicans. So in the Senate, they're virtually tied. Of the 34 seats up for re-election, a handful are being defended by Democrats, and they're in states that Trump won in both 2016 and 2020, including the states of Montana and Ohio. So Republicans need to win only one seat in the Senate, and that's assuming that they'll hold on to the seats that they currently hold, which they probably will, and they will have a majority. And I think that there's probably a 65% chance that they will pick up at least one seat, maybe only one seat, and give them a majority in the Senate. So right now, the projection looks like Democratic White House, Democratic House, Republican Senate, divided government. That means that anything that has to be legislated in 2025 and 2026 must be subject to some kind of bipartisan compromise, in that the president will work on things that presidents can work on without any congressional veto or acquiescence. And that is mostly regulatory issues, trade issues, foreign policy, national defense, things like that.
Thank you, John. Maybe we'll go with that theme in terms of some of those policy proposals. On both sides, we've seen recent proposals ranging from taxes to housing to trade restrictions. Can you help us separate the campaign rhetoric from reality and level set for us what you think a Trump or Harris presidency would look like 2 months out from Election Day?
Sure. Well, hopefully the election would have been called 2 months after Election Day, but you never know in this day and age. So assuming that all is clear and there's a new president in office in January 2025, if it's President Harris, I think there would not be a lot of significant changes. She would likely retain a lot of the Biden folks in key positions in the administration. She would obviously make some changes, but I think for the most part, it would be a Biden-like administration and set of priorities. You'd see the regulatory state still continue their work as they're doing today in the financial space. As Salita mentioned, that could have a big impact. We'd see new rules across the board as they're under proposal now. They would be pursued and implemented. The regulatory agenda that Joe Biden began would continue under Kamala Harris, including in the crucial green energy space and away from fossil fuels. So all of that regulatory activity would continue with pretty much the same people or maybe a handful of new people. Of course, she would have some foreign policy challenges that that would likely reflect Biden policies, Biden sentiments, but there may be some differences. Kamala Harris will certainly want to have her own style of leadership and have her own touch on the policy process. So some of her proposals that you're seeing being discussed in the campaign, the small business tax credit, some of those things she will try to put into place since they are more uniquely hers than Biden's. So she will also begin tax bill negotiations with Republicans in the Senate as a first step. If Donald Trump's elected, we'll see an entirely new arrangement. All the Biden people would leave. Trump would have to hire a lot of people to work in his administration. The really important ones would require Senate confirmation. That would take some time. The Senate's capable of approving a few people a week, not hundreds of people a week. So Trump would be handicapped a little bit initially by not having the full force of federal employees working for him that early. Keep in mind that Trump would also be under some pressure because he can only serve for 4 years. So he'd want to make every day count, make every week count. And all those months that he won't have his people around him to do some of the work that he wants to have done will cost him. But you will see him begin to reverse the regulatory program under Biden. A lot of the green energy financial services regulations and rules would be peeled back. That's a lengthy process, but that process would begin. You'd probably see immediate action at the border, where those seeking asylum would no longer be able to enter the U.S. to make an asylum claim. Trump would likely try to keep those people out of the country or keep them at other countries while their U.S. status is clarified. You might also see him initiate some of the tariffs that he's promised, since that seems to be a priority as well. So there would be a flurry of activity. Most importantly, the tax bill, which would be the biggest thing that Congress works on next year, that wouldn't happen right away. That will be a late 2025 issue. That's going to require a lot of work, a lot of spade work to get from ideas to a more finished product. So that's a late year project, but certainly both presidents would be very busy in their first couple months of next year regardless of who wins.
Thank you, John. Salid, I'll come back to you. And John, you mentioned tariffs. And so, Salid, we have a global audience. I wanted to think about some of the top concerns when it comes to foreign policy around the election. And there's been a lot of talk about tariffs. What could the impact be?
Yeah. So I think it's a very timely question, Jason, because we just published a very comprehensive election watch report specifically on tariffs. And in that report, we basically categorize tariffs that we could see in, I would say, four different outcomes, okay? So the first one I'll start with, we call it gesture politics, which would be basically, it would include retention of the existing tariffs right now, and also maybe some new taxes on specific products with the main intention of making a political point. So that would be one. The next level of tariffs we call selective tariffs, which includes much broader application of trade taxes on maybe across multiple sectors. But I think this would be more targeted towards specific countries. And I still think there is probably possible ways to be able to evade some of them. The third level is universal tariffs, right, which I think are not very much possible to evade in a legal fashion. And then the last one we call extreme tariffs, which would be more or less like the Trump's campaign rhetoric of about replacing income taxes with a suitable tariff rate. And I would say right off the bat, I think it is very unlikely for that to get through. Now, as a general rule, when we think about the impact of tariffs, the more extreme the tariffs are, the more stagflationary they are, right? So if Harris wins, if Vice President Harris wins, we see the most likely outcome to be what we call gesture politics, right? Which would not be too disruptive on growth or inflation, because they would be a lot more targeted and it would be narrowly applied. Now, Trump presidency is much more of a wild card. If he wins, we believe the most likely outcome would be selective tariffs. So the second category that I mentioned, it would be similar to the 2019 U.S. tariffs on China, right? And based on our analysis, we see that the impact would be on a three-year cumulative basis, the hit to GDP would be somewhere around 0.5 percentage point, maybe a little bit more, on the U.S. economy, on Chinese economy, and euro area. So there would be some impact, but not necessarily the kind of impact that would spark a global recession on its own. Now, I think the far greater risk here is universal tariffs. Okay, the three-year cumulative GDP impact, based on our analysis for universal tariffs, would be somewhere between 1 to 1.5%, both on U.S., China, and also euro area. Now, we would expect in that scenario bond yields to come down and equity markets to sell off about 10%. So this is not our base case scenario, but it's certainly a risk that we're monitoring around this tariff, tariff risk.
So we talked about tariffs. The other T in focus are taxes. We've seen some proposals coming from both candidates. How do you see the potential tax policy changing?
Yeah. All right, so maybe we just take one step back, because we just talked about tariffs, which I said is the main risk from a Trump presidency. But then on the other hand, there are tailwinds that would come from a Trump presidency, right? It's looser regulations. We talked about it. And you just asked about, the taxes, lower taxes. That would be a tailwind. Generally, the equity market cheers lower taxes. Now, we have to put things, though, in perspective, because already tax cuts and the Job Act has lowered the corporate taxes from 35% to 21%. So we're not going to be seeing a change of this magnitude again, because inflation and deficit are a concern. So even if the Republicans were to have the majority in Congress, there are a number of people from the Republican Party that you know, who do not want, they don't want to see even further reductions from these levels. So at this point, you could see a slight change and a slight tailwind for the equity markets, but nothing is given from my perspective. Now, on the other side, you have VP Harris, who would like to increase corporate taxes. But as we heard from John just now, he talked about the uphill battle that the Democrats have in the Senate, which is a roadblock. But let's say the Democrats surprise us and they ended up having a small majority. Okay, in that case, I think we could see a moderate increase in corporate taxes. But the more limited scope of this, I think, would translate into roughly, you know, low to mid single digit hit to S&P earnings. Of course, that would bring volatility, but I don't think it would be enough to cause a crash in the market. Maybe I'll finish with personal taxes, moving from corporate taxes, because that has been another hot topic in the news, especially with Vice President Harris, especially around capital gain taxes. But I would say once again, the most extreme proposals around capital gain taxes are unlikely to pass, from my perspective. And in general, when we look at historically, moderate capital gains tax changes have not had a noticeable impact on the financial markets.
Thank you, John. I'll go to you with our last question of the program. We're also receiving submitted questions in the studio, so I'll send those to both you and Salita, you know, after this. But where, you know, election day is right around the corner, what do you expect ultimately will decide the race in the coming weeks?
Well, Jason, it's important to realize that the race actually begins next week. Early voting will begin in Pennsylvania, so the candidates are scrambling to get their messages, to get their final word out to a handful of voters. Election day will really be just the last day that people are able to vote as we kind of go through this rolling vote process. But I think the key thing in this election over the next couple of months will be that small group of voters who I referenced earlier, the 5 to 7 to 8% of the independent vote that is still undecided, they will be the targets for both the for both the Harris and Trump campaigns. This group knows a lot about Trump. They've seen Trump. Some of them may have voted for Trump in the past. They know Donald Trump very well. They don't know Kamala Harris as well. I think they're still trying to figure her out. They saw her last night. That helped them kind of fill in the picture about who she is, what her policies are, whether she has the temperament, character to be president. I think that the assessment of Harris by these voters is really what's going to be the most crucial dynamic over the next couple of months, and how they decide or how what they conclude is their assessment of her and her ability to lead and to be successful is what's going to determine whether they vote for her or him. And I think that that jury is still out. Again, Harris had a good night last night, but she needs a couple of other victories to really cement this. And there could be some October surprises. There could be some September surprises. As we know, the world is at war in different theaters. Something could come up in that area that could all of a sudden exploit a Harris or Trump strength or weakness that might push this race in one direction or the other. But assuming none of that happens, then I think what voters are looking for, they're looking for additional signs as to whether Harris can do this job and whether they're comfortable with her. And that'll be what their focus, what this small group of voters' focuses will be over the next couple of months.
Thank you, John. Now we'll open it up for our audience Q&A. We have time here for, you know, a couple questions. As a reminder for our viewers, if you have a question for any of our guests, please submit them via the Ask Question button on your screen. So, John, let me start with you with the first question from the audience. Do you expect another debate?
Well, I was very surprised that Harris asked for another debate. in my view, she won the debate. She can move on and focus on other things. I don't know that another debate helps her. It would help Trump, I think, because he might recover from a performance last night that I don't think was very good. So I would be surprised if there was another debate. I know they're talking about one, but I would be surprised if there was one. But we'll see. I know they're talking. I don't see another one.
Got it. Helpful. Sleet, I'll come to you. This is a very, you know, investment question as someone from the audience. Should people be making any changes to their portfolio right now?
Okay. I'll start with our line, which we bring up at every election season. First of all, I think it's much better to express political views through a vote rather than portfolio changes, because as I mentioned, it's too close to call, momentum shifts. It is much better, especially for our clients who invest for the long term, to stick with their goals, with their plans. And there are some tactical, maybe interesting trade opportunities that come up, but it's not a major portfolio shift. So I would not make major portfolio shifts. And if anything, if there is any worry one way or the other, maybe I would put hedges on a portfolio and not necessarily sell out from one sector or the other because it's more prone to election changes. And I would say a good hedge for the portfolio is gold. I think it has proven its value as a hedge against geopolitical tensions, protectionism, and the fact that we expect lower interest rates is also supportive of, you know, gold prices. So I would stick with a hedge, not a major change in portfolios.
I like that advice, and as our interest is to help our clients reach their financial goals, I wore a green tie today to be purely aligned with those outcomes. John, another question to you regarding a candidate, both candidates, and impact on foreign policy. This is an area where they could have some impact, even with a divided Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. A president can largely do what he or she wants in the foreign policy arena. Congress has to appropriate money and sometimes do important things like declare war. But for the most part, the president has a free hand in what he or she wants to do. I think that the big question that I've been asked about that seems to be on the minds of the markets, and I hear this from different people, in that regard as well, is Trump's volatility in foreign affairs, does it help or does it hurt? And then you look at the perception of some that Biden has been somewhat weak on foreign policy. Would Harris continue along those lines? Are there dangers in either approach in accelerating wars beyond those that we're involved with now or closing them down? And you know, people have different views about who would be more effective on deterrence and on managing current war. So I think there are some big differences here, and we would see those differences put in play on day one, really, since this is something that a president could do again without Congress, and would be subject to some very early action.
Thank you, John. I'll come back to maybe our last clash, our question for the program. I'll ask it to both of you in, you know, slightly different fashion. The question came in: do we foresee either party addressing the deficit? So maybe the practicality of that, John, and then Sleet, I'll come to you in the studio. For, you know, how that could potentially impact markets and investments. So, John, to you first.
Jason, I don't see either Harris or Trump taking meaningful steps to address the deficit. It's not something that either has shown a particular interest in. If you look at most of their priority proposals, they would all expand the deficit. There's not really often comments about how they would offset a lot of new spending or tax proposals. So I don't think either candidate would meaningfully address the deficit. The deficit would go up, the debt would go up. My view has been for a long time that the country needs more of a crisis to finally address the deficit, and that will come in Social Security and Medicare in a few years, probably not be dealt with in a meaningful way, in my view, in either a Trump or Harris administration.
So, Salita, based on that, unless there's a crisis, how does that impact our portfolios?
First of all, I echo John's view. Unless there's an imminent crisis, I don't think anybody is going to make it a priority. And in addition to some of the sort of what would constitute a crisis, I would say one of the measures of stability around us is the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar, you know, up and down, but has been relatively stable unless it's in a completely free fall. I don't think it triggers much. Also in the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, market did force the hand of the politicians to do something about it in the form of much higher interest rates. We also don't have that challenge right now. From our perspective, look, our portfolios, it's a risk that we monitor, but I don't think it's going to be handled in the near term. In our portfolios, we are right now positioned, we have been positioned for interest rates coming down, and that actually has happened in the 10-year, we're like 3.65. Long end has come down significantly with the expectation of Fed cuts in the near term. We feel like, you know, maybe it has gone a little too far. We might see a little consolidation there in the near term. But, you know, if we get a sense that it was approaching, you know, crisis levels, then we would have to position the portfolio for potentially higher rates. And right now, that's not our view. But we have, you know, hedges in our portfolios.
Salita, great way to end. John, thank you for joining us today from D.C. I want to thank our entire audience for tuning in today. As a reminder, you can visit ubs.com/electionwatch for our latest content, including the weekly Road to the Election video series, with a new episode out every Thursday at 4:30 Eastern on a range of election topics. Also, keep a lookout for the CIO's upcoming report, 24 questions for the 24 elections later this week. Thank you again and enjoy the rest of your day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.